The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. PYC is still in full swing here at Edstone and going very well. The campers all went into London yesterday. Mr. Flurry went with them. They walked around some of the big sites like Buckingham Palace and the Houses of Parliament. They also spent some time in the British Museum, which is just a great place to visit anyway, full of all kinds of interesting and important artifacts from history. And most excitingly, as you've heard on some of these programs on this channel, there are quite a few artifacts in there that confirm accounts of events in the Bible. And, you know, much as I love that museum, one of the sad parts about it is those artifacts aren't necessarily well signposted or highlighted. They're just kind of almost, they're very easy to overlook unless you know about them. And so the campers, they had a lecture the day before they went, talking and with PowerPoint, showing them some of the things to expect, the things to look out for. They had the staff going around, the camp staff going around with them, helping them to find many of those artifacts. So I'm sure that was a great experience for them. They also went to the cabinet war rooms where Winston Churchill was kind of working and running the country for a lot of World War II. I'm sure that was another great experience for them. You can see how dedicated a lot of the people were, working round the clock for the war effort, right at the top of the government there. You can see how Churchill lived during that just most crucial part of his life and how the government was run then. I'm sure you'll hear more about these visits later. I think Mr. Stephen Flowery will be back on the show tomorrow, all being well. I didn't go with them on the trip, but you don't need to feel sorry for me. My wife and I took the opportunity of having the campers all away for the evening to go and see Julius Caesar at the Royal Shakespeare Company Theatre here in Stratford. That was the first time I've seen a professional production, and Julius Caesar is one of my favourite plays. Definitely worth seeing if you have the opportunity. It wasn't the version, by the way, where they stab an actor dressed up like Donald Trump. The Caesar in this version looked nothing like Mr. Trump and was all set in Rome instead of some kind of weird modern setting. And that's something we'll probably come back to later if we have time. I did have some things from that I wanted to share with you and apply to the news today. But seeing as our campers were in London yesterday, I wanted to introduce you to a new and dangerous trend that is sweeping London. Unfortunately, it's a very unpleasant subject, but it's not one that we can be ignorant of. As Mr. Flurry talked about to the campers last week, we need to have a realistic picture of this world as it is. We can't over-glamorize what is out there. So here's a clip, I think this is from The National, introducing this horrifying new trend that is sweeping across London.
Samir Hussein's mask protects sensitive new skin grafted from his leg and forehead. The lasting scars of a night out with a friend at the movies. They'd run afoul of two other guys looking for trouble. Verbal taunts turned vicious when Hussein was hit with acid.
You can feel your skin sort of caving in and sort of melting away. And my instant thought at that time was, why me? Because I didn't do anything wrong. So I burned my arm just all along here. So I shielded my face when the acid was thrown. My jacket was burnt. There was a hole in my jeans. My T-shirt was half gone as well. And I did get acid in my eye as well, in both of them.
That was 2 years ago.
Did it hurt in your eyes?
In London, the acid attacks have only escalated.
Where has this happened, sir?
Just here.
A scooter rampage last week. Two attackers, six victims, two of them delivery couriers. The drive-by crime and rising threat is rattling Londoners, the government, and the guys who ride for a living, like Louise Juner.
Basically, everybody's scared now, everybody's afraid to work, and it's in a couple of, areas and zones, because it's been a very dangerous zone to go.
So that's the horrifying new trend of acid attacks increasing in London. Everybody's scared. everybody's afraid to go into certain parts of London. You heard that delivery driver saying. So something that's been on the news after earlier this week, an acid attack was caught on camera. But it's a crime wave that's been building for some time now. In 2015, there were 261 acid attacks. Last year, it was 454, almost doubling in 1 year. I think there was an increase of around 75%. And Jaff Shah, who's the executive director of Acid Survivors Trust International, he says that acid attacks tend to be underreported. The gangs are involved in a lot of these attacks, and victims fear that they'll be attacked again if they come forward to the police. And as you heard from that clip, it's spreading a lot of fear. There's delivery drivers refusing to visit some parts of London. Actually, attacks on food delivery drivers are becoming so common. They held a protest outside Parliament on July 18th, just a few weeks ago, begging authorities to do more to stop this. One of the signs, for example, read, "We are not safe to deliver food at your doors." The attacks on delivery drivers, they're just one facet of this growing crime wave. Here's another clip about this new crime wave. This one from a Vice News documentary that they put together.
"Recently, I got a text from a friend warning me to stay away from Mare Street in Hackney. Thieves on scooters were going around throwing acid into people's faces so they could make off with their bags and phones. It was the first time I'd ever heard of acid being used outside of an honor or revenge-based attack and as a weapon to commit petty theft. I almost didn't believe it. No one expects acid to be thrown on them on a night out."
Since 2010, there have been 1,800 reported acid attacks in the capital, with a steep 70% rise from 2015 to 2016. As the number of victims grows, data suggests Britain has the worst record in the developed world for assaults with household acids like bleach and drain cleaner.
"My identity has changed because of what's happened, because I am scarred for life, so I'm not the person I wanted to be."
Britain leads the world in acid attacks. And as you heard there, it's become a tool of petty theft. And this is it's a different trend than in the rest of the world. Acid attacks in a lot of the rest of the world, they tend to be attacks on women. They're things like so-called honor attacks, where someone, a relative, feels that a girl has dishonored the family and so they permanently scar them with acid. Or somebody wants revenge on someone, and so they pour acid on them as a way of kind of forever trying to ruin their looks, to just burn a girl's face off. And those are absolutely horrible crimes, and they do happen in the UK. But in the UK, they're expanding as well. It's got the point now where somewhere between about 20% and 80% of all victims of acid attacks are male, whereas in the rest of the world, it is mostly female. You heard about Feth there, where people they'll be on a motorbike, they'll ride up to someone, throw acid in their face, and while they're kind of screaming and writhing in pain, while it feels like their face is melting off, and in often cases literally is, they'll take their wallet and their phone and drive away. Now, motorbike crime just by itself is another rising trend in London, with people riding up on motorbikes, robbing, threatening people with knives, and riding off again. And that alone is pretty horrible. But then to combine that with this rising acid attack is a pretty terrifying trend. There was another famous attack a couple of months ago where there were a couple of groups of guys in a nightclub, and they pulled out acid that they'd been carrying with them, and they started throwing at each other, and in the end, 20 people got caught in the crossfire. Two were left blind in one eye, another couple were left with severe facial injuries, many others with scars. Here's another quick clip from that Vice documentary talking about just how widespread this crime is becoming.
"An incident involving such a large group of people is rare, but the Mango attack confirmed that the use of chemicals as a weapon is now horrifyingly common in the UK. Earlier this year, there were reports of acid attacks happening in the suburbs just outside London, from a 17-year-old throwing industrial drain cleaner over five teenagers at a train station, to chemicals being thrown at a kid's football game, and even between school children, one of them as young as 12.
So it's reached the point children are bringing acid with them to school to attack people with at football games. It's becoming horrifyingly common. I saw another video with somebody where they had just horrible permanent burns on their face. Just about their whole face was burned and permanently disfigured. And he said, well, you know, one day he was at home. There was a knock at the door. He opened it. Someone said, this is for you, mate, and threw acid in his face. And what had he done to be a part of this? What had he kind of got involved in some kind of criminal gang and become a part of gang rivalry or violence? Well, actually, he'd done nothing. The attacker had the wrong address. The attacker had even intended to get someone else. I'm not even saying that they deserved it, obviously. But he just was completely innocent, completely nothing to do with the ones that attacked him, and was disfigured for life. And the aftermath of these attacks can be horrific. If people get acid in their eyes, they can be blinded. If they swallow any, or if it goes up their nostrils, they can be left unable to breathe or unable to eat without medical help. Katie Piper was an earlier victim of this, and she set up a foundation to help others. And she said that for acid attack survivors, the aftermath is a life sentence. And she's gone through over 250 operations. She did end up swallowing some of the acid, and she's undergone already 250 operations. She's just going to continue to need therapy, to need operations so that she can eat even for the rest of her life. So why? Why is this happening? Why has London become, well, basically, it looks like the acid attack capital of the world, or at the least the developing world? Why is this rising in the UK? Why are criminals starting to use acid as a weapon? Well, here's how former Metropolitan Chief Superintendent Dal Babu answered that question. And then you also hear from Jermaine Loyola, a former gang member, on a TV breakfast show.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was in the police, I dealt with domestic violence instances where men had thrown acid on women who were about to leave them. It was horrific, absolutely horrific. And what we've seen over the last few years is that gang members have now used it as a weapon of choice.
It's, why?
Well, easily accessible. Guns are extremely... thankfully, you can't get guns in this country. And if you do get guns, you have to get homemade bullets. You know, guns aren't very accurate. They are not very, very useful to gang members. Knives, you commit an offence. You commit an offence per se. For example, if you've got a knife which is longer than 3 inches, then it's an offence completely.
Just carrying it, being in possession.
Absolutely, yeah. Susanna. Just carrying it is an offence.
Yeah. Whereas if you are caught carrying acid, as Biz was going to say, then you can just say, just off to do
absolutely
some cleaning.
You can go in, you can buy it on the internet, you can buy sulfuric acid on the internet. My 15-year-old daughter could get onto the internet and order sulfuric acid.
Jermaine, you were in a gang. Is this the reason that gang members now use it?
Yeah, partly because it's easy to access, it's easy to conceal. If you're a criminal and you're one of these young men that find yourself in one of these vicious cycles of constantly being in danger, you have to understand the mentality that these young men have, that they're in a gang, that they have enemies, and their enemies are using acid. So, like you were saying, for example, you can't bring a knife to a gunfight. Carrying acid, you're gonna be able to cause a person to be a victim for life. If you get caught, you're not gonna get that harsh of a sentence. In comparison to if you was carrying a knife and you used that knife, that person's a good chance they could die. Or alternative would be that they'll have a colostomy bag.
So you can cause maximum pain, agony, wounding, but actually a minimum
receive less custodial sentence for it.
See, that's extraordinary.
And that's the picture of crime in Britain today. And in fact, the most recent statistics show still that gun crime, knife crime is going up. Gun crime was up nearly 50% in London. So there is a much wider crime rate wave. Knife crime was up by a quarter. And now you get criminals turning more and more to acid. As you heard there, there's no laws about carrying around a bottle of liquid. Bottles of liquid, a bottle of sulfuric acid is going to pass easily through any metal detector. As you heard there, if somebody's carrying a knife, even if they don't necessarily do anything with it, they can be prosecuted just for carrying a knife, depending on how long it is. But it's hard to jail someone carrying a bottle of bleach, even if you're pretty sure that they're going to go and throw it over someone, it's very hard to prosecute. As you also heard there, it's a lot lower sentence if a gang member stabs or if a criminal stabs someone, they can get prosecuted for attempted murder. But if they pour acid on someone, it's grievous bodily harm, and it's a much lower sentence. And really, the consequences of an acid attack victim may be far worse than for a stabbing. Now, it's important to note here that so far, we've been calling this acid attacks, we've been talking about acid attacks. That's the main label that's used in the press. It's a simple one-syllable word. More accurately, we're talking about corrosive substances. So as I mentioned, bleach has been used, ammonia, which technically isn't an acid, is something that has been used in some of these attacks. And these types of corrosive liquids are easy to get a hold of. You heard on the clip there about buying sulfuric acid online. A lot of these you don't even have to go online. Bleach is available in every supermarket. Drain cleaner or unblocker, well, that's almost pure sulfuric acid. Often over 90% and more sulfuric acid when it comes to drain unblocker. And you can get those at just about any DIY store. You can just go in there and buy drain unblocker. And criminals can buy these with cash. They become then untraceable. And it's something that's very hard for authorities to address in the same way that they've addressed guns and knives. How do you restrict people from being able to buy drain cleaner? Or what about bleach? And people are talking about some solutions that, okay, maybe will make some difference in the short term. Maybe there are some things that you could do to restrict people buying drain cleaner or make it so they have to buy it with a credit card so that at least it's more traceable. There's also, maybe they could do things like tougher sentences for acid attacks so that it's not seen as kind of the soft option. But this whole story really illustrates the flaw in the way in Britain, America, and the whole rest of the world really addresses these problems, all problems related to crime and policing. In cracking down on guns and knives and now acid, authorities are targeting effects. And fine, there might be occasions for doing that, but you can never confuse that for a proper solution to the problem, for really getting to the cause. They're not even facing the cause of the problem. And some of these people involved in this will freely admit that. I didn't bring the clip with me, but that former gang member went on to talk about how, well, actually, you need to get to the cause of why people are joining gangs, why people feel like they need to be violent. And some of the others have made the same point, and they're absolutely right. And so treating the effects, okay, maybe there's going to be some short-term results, but you can never confuse that for a permanent solution. And we see this as the standard response and often the only response to all kinds of violent threats. You have terrorists are attacking us with guns or with explosives, and so authorities crack down on guns and explosives, and so then terrorists start using knives and trucks. And if you start cracking down on those, they'll move to something else. And authorities are just left playing whack-a-mole. You address one effect or one means of attack, crack down on one weapon, and they just switch to another. And there's no need. There's no end of everyday objects that can be used as weapons. And it applies even beyond. You can see how it applies with terrorism, and they never get to the cause, and they never go after nations like Iran that are sponsoring terrorism, the ideology behind terrorism, the preachers that are encouraging terrorism. Because just addressing the effects or just addressing some of those weapons, well, that's much easier. Much easier just to try and introduce legislation on guns, or much easier to limit what explosives people can buy and make it harder for people to buy fertilizer. Not that some of those things are wrong, but it's much easier to do that. And doing those things, well, they're never going to solve the problem in the long term. And so for Britain to really solve its crime epidemic, it's got to look much deeper than the weapons used. But you see this throughout society's approach to everything. You see it with health as well. You see rising obesity. And okay, fine, there is some talk about, well, how can we promote healthy lifestyles, healthy eating, healthy activities? But what's much more common in practice is there a drug that we can make? I saw a headline this morning just talking about, okay, well, we've got some kind of, we've figured out some kind of gene that we can tweak to try and eliminate obesity, or is there a drug that we can give people to eliminate obesity? And that's just the way mankind approaches all of his problems, just looking at the effects. I mean, while we're on the subject of obesity, we do have an article up on the website right now by Abraham Blondeau that just deals with another shocking side point of this obesity epidemic, where the number of people eligible to serve in the military is shrinking dramatically. In 1991, 50% of the population was eligible to serve in the military, or of young people. Now it's fallen to 25%. And health isn't the only reason people aren't eligible, but it's one of the fastest growing ones. And at the same time, you have a growing problem with obesity in the military. But you have all of these problems from all kinds of different walks of life. And instead of addressing the cause, which is hard, we go for the quick fix and focus on something much more related to the effect. And so if Britain's going to solve its crime epidemic, because it's had these problems, it had problems with gun crime, then it had problems with knife crime. Now it's problems with, well, still with gun and knife crime, but now also with acid crime. To really solve this, rather than just force criminals to adopt a different weapon, well, you've got to look at the cause. You've got to look at why there are criminals in the first place. So, for example, you've got to look at family. And Andrew Miller, here's an article in the July issue of the Trumpet magazine where he talks about why morality matters, and about how actually so many of the problems we experience today get back to personal morality and even family morality. He writes, children who grow up without a father figure are 4 times likelier to be poor, 9 times likelier to drop out of school, 11 times likelier to commit violent crime, 20 times likelier to be arrested. There is a direct link between the fracturing of families and major societal problems. A bit further down, he writes, it's no coincidence that the per capita rate of violent crime has doubled in the United States since 1960, and the percentage of Americans living in a home that receives some form of means-tested welfare has also doubled. And he just talks about how the family breakdown is behind so much of that. And there's an infographic, a great infographic in the Trumpet print, that contains all the statistics to back all of that up. And that's what Britain needs to be looking at if they're going to really solve this rising crime problem. Not looking at regulating acid, though, as I said, maybe there is more that they can do there to have some kind of short-term effect while they start to get to grips with these longer-term problems. But what is the British government doing when it comes to family? Well, actually, as you hear about almost every day on this radio show, they're pursuing policies that destroy the family, that break down the family. They're promoting things to destroy father figures, to eliminate men from families, to make it illegal to show traditional families on adverts on television, for example. Promoting families that the evidence shows does not work and leads to more of these kind of problems. But to me, this whole subject, it's one that really, I mean, it shows the problem in Britain's knife crime, in Britain's criminal scene. It also shows the problem in the way man addresses problems. The way man goes at a much broader problem in just the way man looks for solutions. It really illustrates the need for God's kingdom, for him to straighten out the problems that we have. Because who's going in this world is going to look at the causes of the problems that we face? Now, back when people were cracking down on knives, I would have never expected people to turn to drain cleaner as an alternative for a knife. And if we crack down on acid, well, what's going to be the next thing that pops up? The next unexpected weapon. There's no shortage of everyday objects that can be used as weapons. And if history's taught us anything, it's taught us that the human mind is incredibly creative when it comes to making weapons. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, often spoke about cause and effect, about how God's way is practical because it gets to the cause of our problems and fixes them that way. and we need to look deeper into what causes this. I did just a quick search this morning looking for where Mr. Armstrong talks about cause and effect and the need for looking at causes in terms of solving man's problems. And it's there. There's an abundance of him doing that. Here's a couple of clips from what he said in a TV program titled The Need for Spiritual Knowledge about the importance of cause and effect.
For every result, there has to be a cause. A cause for every effect. The effect today is nothing but trouble, sorrow, discontent. People are not happy today. Many are in abject poverty. The world is filled with sickness and trouble. And actually, in just a few years, 10 or 15 years, the amount of money spent on doctors, hospitals, medicines, nurses will equal the amount of the gross national product of the whole United States in this country. I've been researching that recently, and that's how great it will be. As we have more and more inventions, more and more development, we also have increasing troubles. People are not happy today. The world is filled with discontent, with bitterness, with resentment, person against person. And unhappiness is filling the air today, absolutely filling it. Well, I say it had to have a beginning. And people don't realize, if you can't get to the cause, you can't understand it, and you can't possibly have an effect. And it all had a beginning at the time of the creation of the first man.
So there's a cause for all of the problems that we see today, for the crime that we see, for all of the other problems that he mentioned, the family breakdown, the unhappiness, the war. There's a cause. And as you heard at the end there, Mr. Armstrong, you often said, well, we have to go back to the beginning of this world to understand that cause. Here's another clip of him talking about the importance of getting to the cause of the problems. And this, I didn't actually write down exactly where this came from, but I believe this one came from a sermon that he gave at some point during the 1980s.
There is naturally a cause for every effect. Now, we have the effect of this paradox. We have great minds in the world that can do great things, and still we can't solve our problems. We can't bring world peace, it seems. We have a world full of trouble, and there has to be a reason. There had to be a cause. When we go back to the origin of humanity, we find that mankind started out on this world on the philosophy that I call the philosophy of get. Now, there are two broad philosophies of life, generally speaking. One is the way of get, and that is the way people are living. The other is the way of give, or of cooperation and help for one another instead of competition and strife. Because mankind started out on this earth in the very beginning in the philosophy of get, it finally became natural, and we call it human nature. So I can tell you in just two words the cause of all of the troubles and the reason we don't have peace at the present time in the world. Those two words are human nature. Until mankind can learn that the way of competition, of selfishness, of get instead of give, of trying to take and get instead of wanting to share and cooperate and help one another, we are never going to have peace.
So human nature, the cause of all of these problems. And as he went on to talk about mankind acquired human nature back in Eden at his beginning, And so Mr. Armstrong went back to the beginning to really help us understand the cause of this world's problems. Because as he said, if we can't find the cause, we can't have the solution. So he showed us how mankind got human nature. The Bible tells us now that in these end times, man waxes worse and worse. You have more family breakdown, contributing to more selfishness, more violence. And this is the cause of these big problems that man is facing. And the solution, as he talked about, is changing human nature. And that's done through godly family life. It's done, well, it's something really that only God can do. But this is the way that things like Britain's acid attacks will be solved. Ultimately, it gets to problems in the human heart, and it means changing human nature. Well, how does that happen? Well, just listen to one last clip on this subject from Mr. Armstrong. And this was, again, I think this was from a sermon given during the Feast of Tabernacles.
Why do we live in a world like we do? There has to be a cause for every effect. Something had to cause it. Something is continually causing all of the troubles in this world. But people are trying to deal with the effect, and you never can cure the effect until you get to the cause and change that. Now, you can say the cause is human nature, but people don't understand human nature. They don't realize what it is. They don't know what is its origin. They don't know where human nature came from. But something is going to have to cause that utopia I've been telling you about. What in the world could cause that? How do you expect human beings to change? Frankly, I don't. You people are not going to change. The people in the world are not going to change. I hope most of you people in this audience have already changed. I hope you've let God change you by putting His Spirit within you.
So as he said there, if we're going to have a world free of these problems, well, there's got to be a cause. Something has got to cause those problems to not be there. In his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, Mr. Armstrong wrote that if crime is to be greatly reduced, then wiped out, there will be a reason. And that's what Britain needs. That's what London needs with all of these gruesome crimes. It says people may have guesses, opinions, theories about what causes crime, but the answer is human nature. What is the cause of wars? The answer is human nature. Why do people steal, murder, commit adultery or fornication, covet what is not theirs? Human nature. We shall never have utopia on earth until human nature is changed. But you say man can't change human nature. And then Mr. Armstrong answers, oh, but God can. And that's precisely what the living Christ is going to do when he returns to rule all nations of the earth. And ultimately, that's the only way to stop the crime we see around us. Yes, there are things that man can do. There are kind of practical Bible-based solutions, things like the traditional family that if people follow them, will make my life better, even in this world. But if man doesn't want to keep playing whack-a-mole with his problems, with these different types of weapons that people keep using, he's got to really get to the cause. And that's, to me, what this story really illustrates. And it shows, you know, and that is exactly how God is going to bring peace in the wonderful world tomorrow. I was looking through Mr. Armstrong's book, Wonderful World Tomorrow, this morning, and I was kind of surprised, probably shouldn't have been, but it is a bit surprising just how much in that book he talks about cause and effect. The word cause or causes, and I'm not counting any synonyms of that, but just the word cause or causes, that occurs around 35 times in the book. That's almost every other page. And the Wonderful World Tomorrow booklet in so many ways is a book about cause and effect. He begins by talking about, well, what does the world right now look like? What are the causes of the world right now? And then he goes through all of the Bible prophecies of a very different world that is coming. The Bible is full of prophecies of that wonderful world tomorrow. And then Mr. Armstrong talks about how something has got to cause the change. There's got to be a cause for that different world. And he talks about the cause. And you can get that book for free, like you can all of the books that we mention on this website. That is a book that's just absolutely full of hope. It is talking about this crime wave. It is kind of a depressing or discouraging subject. But that book is full of hope of the only real way to get rid of that and understanding the world as it really is right now and the problems that are really there that we may not want to think and talk about. Well, they help us to really appreciate and look forward to that wonderful world tomorrow that the Bible talks so much about. So you can get that for free on our website on thetrumpet.com. just click on the literature request tab up on the top right-hand corner. So yes, addressing the real causes of Britain's crime is hard. But that's exactly how God will soon bring peace, through cause and effect. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll talk just for the last little bit about Shakespeare and how that applies to just an important piece of news coming out of Germany.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. As I mentioned right at the start of the day's program last night, my wife and I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company Theatre here in Stratford to watch Julius Caesar. And that is one of my favourite Shakespeare plays, mostly because it just deals with so many of the kind of the big issues of history and some of these big timeless themes. You know, there's the whole question about kingship and should one man rule, and you know, Shakespeare in there, he makes the case for both sides, and he kind of puts both sides almost in a favorable light and an unfavorable light equally, those that killed Caesar and those that supported him, the kind of the fickleness and senseless violence of the mob is something else that also just really stands out, I think, from that play, and something that just really applies to a lot of what we see in the news today, the way that the kind of the people of Rome, the mob, switch between first cheering Pompey and then cheering Pompey's killer, Caesar, then cheering Caesar's killer, Brutus, then back to cheering the men that want to kill Brutus. There's the way that the mob just tears someone to pieces just because he happens to have the same name as one of the conspirators. You know, they know that he's not one of the conspirators, and you know, they're just kind of in this emotional frenzy, and they just say, oh, I'll kill him anyway, and they end up tearing him to pieces. And you see echoes of that in the mobs across America's university campuses that you see today, and their blind, irrational hatred for whatever says anything that sparks off their anger. But one of the things that really stood out to me this time is just the power of rhetoric. And rhetoric is something itself that the Romans gloried in, and just the ability of a strong speaker to change the world. I think it's something that we kind of forget nowadays, maybe because we're just accosted by so many words. Maybe it's because we don't have any orators like that in modern Britain and America. There aren't the type of speakers that can turn world events around their world, that can craft a speech that changes the destiny of nations. Perhaps the best example that we've seen in recent times was Winston Churchill, with the student or the campus there yesterday visiting those cabinet war rooms. But we saw You know, in World War II, his words galvanized a nation. You know, without those words, would Britain have had the will to fight? Or would Britain have made peace with Germany in May 1940? There's a short book, I'm trying to remember the name, by I think it was by John Lukacs, something like 5 Days in London, I think was the title, talking about just how close Britain came to making a peace with Germany after France fell over in May 1940, and how disastrous for the entire world history that would have been. And Lucas kind of makes the point, though, well, if Churchill had done absolutely nothing else but just stop Britain from making that peace with Germany in 1940, well, that alone was just a huge contribution to mankind. And his speeches, it was galvanizing the nation, bringing politicians, bringing the people behind opposing Hitler, no matter what the cost. Those were speeches. Those were words that changed the course of history. And Shakespeare illustrates this in Julius Caesar. And one of the big ways he does this is with, and one of Shakespeare's most famous speeches comes from Mark Antony's oration at Caesar's funeral, the famous friends, Romans, countrymen speech. The people of Rome were at first they were angry with Brutus and the conspirators for killing Caesar, and then Brutus gets up and he gives his speech, itself a masterful oration, and the crowd swings behind Brutus, even calling for Brutus to be made king. And then it's Mark Antony's turn. And he gives the speech that changes the face of the fate of Rome. He turns the people against Brutus and the conspirators so powerfully that they have to flee the city and are ultimately defeated at the Battle of Philippi. In real life, I don't know how much exactly hung on Antony's speech. I think it is something that Roman historians themselves point to, but I'm not an expert on that. But certainly in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Mark Antony's speech changes the fate of Rome, changes the fate of the world by changing the minds of the Romans. And in this speech, he's heavily constrained. You know, he's promised not to say anything negative about Brutus or the conspirators. He's speaking by their permission. He's speaking after Brutus. And yet, despite all of those constraints, despite not being able to say anything negative about the conspirators, this is a speech that changes the fate of the Roman Empire. I'll play a quick excerpt of that speech now. This is a version performed by Damian Lewis.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honourable man, so are they all honourable men, come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honourable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honourable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal, I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and sure, he is an honourable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me. M- My heart is in the coffin there with Caesar. And I must pause till it come back to me.
That was the start of Mark Antony's funeral speech from Julius Caesar. And there's much, much more to it. And it was really well done. That's not the version that they had last night. Obviously different actors, but it was really well done last night. I don't know whether I've seen a professional production of Shakespeare before. I've seen plenty of amateur ones, but it really was an excellent, excellent production. Even if you don't think Shakespeare is for you, I'd really recommend going and seeing that. But he, in that speech, he goes on, and you can see so much even in that speech of the same rhetorical techniques that modern politicians use. Mark Antony goes on to talk about how he's no great orator. In the same, while giving one of the most famous examples of great oratory in history, in the same way that just about every politician claims that they are no politician. That's the beginning of that speech where he turned Rome around. And you, like I said, this was something that was really glorified in ancient Rome. Cicero's anti-Catiline speeches, the Catilinarian speeches, have become probably the most famous and studied speeches in the history of the world. And most often imitated as well. And Rome, Greece before it, celebrated the power of words to move the world. And it is still the case, but that's something that because we haven't had any examples of this recently in our nations, we so often forget. In his former prophet's booklet, Mr. Flowey quotes George Will, writing that when history is taught at all nowadays, it's often taught as the unfolding of inevitabilities, of vast impersonal forces. The role of contingency in history is disparaged, so students are inoculated against the undemocratic notions that history can be turned in its course by great individuals. And this kind of criticism of this way of speaking, that goes all the way back to men like, I think Isaiah Berlin was talking about some of those similar things in the 1950s. So this kind of view of history where everything is inevitable is something that's really, it's built into our education, and we forget how much great individuals, even great speeches, can change the world and just kind of assume that things just naturally follow the predetermined course. I did want to finish today. I don't know how much longer or how much I'll be able to get into about a set of words that's making a big splash in Germany that shows the potential for this kind of thing to really change Germany, change the world here. There's an obscure group of essays by published in a tiny publishing house that's just been storming its way up the German bestsellers list. It's a collection of historians written by Wolf-Peter Sieferle in 2015. He committed suicide the next year. The mainstream press has shunned it, and it's almost literally flying off the shelves regardless. He was only a small publishing house that tends to publish far-right publications, was the only one that would accept it. But it happened to get on, or someone put it on the Süddeutsche Zeitung's non-fiction book of the month list. The Süddeutsche Zeitung very quickly decided that was a mistake and have even suspended publishing their non-fiction book of the month list entirely because of this. But once this book was brought to the German public's attention, it's just been astonishingly successful. It reached the number one spot on Amazon's German bestsellers list. The publisher said they were selling 250 of these books an hour until they ran out of copies. Completely sold out. And there's rumors circulating in the German press. I think the New Statesman talked about this, that companies are being kind of pressured into finding ways of stopping this book from even being reprinted. It reached sixth in Spiegel's list of best-selling non-fiction books before Spiegel struck it from the list artificially and said they didn't want to give it any more publicity. Christopher Caldwell, he was writing about this book in the New York Times, and he wrote that when the German literary establishment unanimously denounced Mr. Sieferle's work as an extremist tract, readers did not nod in agreement. They pulled out their wallets and said, "That must be the book for me." This is a sign that distrust of authority in Germany has reached worrisome levels, possibly American ones. And that alone is a worrying development, that the media just, they really embraced Angela Merkel's open door to Middle Eastern migrants, and they've just lost the trust of a huge segment of the German population, not a kind of minority of far-right extremists, but a lot of Germans no longer listen when the press calls something extreme, and that's something that I don't really have time to get into, but it's something we've been talking about and pointing to as a result of the migrant crisis for some years now. So what is the message of this book that is really taking Germany by storm? Well, in this book, Seefeld, he makes no attempts to justify Hitler or diminish his crime, but instead his main argument is that Germans are the new Jews. He argues that the Jews are were unfairly held responsible for the crucifixion of Christ and collectively punished for it, and so in the same way Germans were unfairly held responsible, all Germans, for the Holocaust, and they're now being collectively punished for it. He talks about how Germans are being taught to hate their own nation and that they're busy working to destroy it by immersing it in the European Union so that they can be Europeans and not Germans, and that this is leading to the end of Germany, the Finis Germania, which is the title of his book. He talks about how he says, well, Britain and America have plenty of shameful history, but he writes that this history, quote, pearls off like water from a well-polished boot, and that Germany is instead uniquely and unfairly victimized for its crime. He says that the people in Britain and America and the West have to face a painful truth, that Germany's no different to them. He says that if Germany belongs to the most progressive, civilized, cultivated countries, then Auschwitz means that at any moment the human progress of modernity can go into reverse. So the Holocaust could have happened anywhere, he argues, and that Germany is just and that in fact Britain and America did in fact commit other atrocities. He kind of attacks this notion that the Holocaust was unique and talks about how, yes, there were other crimes, maybe not as large as the Holocaust, but on the same scale, he argues, and that Germany has no more really to be ashamed of than Britain and America, and that Germany must be proud of itself. If it's to avoid the end of Germany, Germans must be proud of being Germans once again. They must stand up for their nation once again. Germany must stand up for its interests on the world scene, be much less restrained. And he ties this kind of reinterpretation of history directly into the migrant crisis. He says that it's this Germans' lack of pride in its own history and culture that has led to them accepting millions of migrants. Now, as I said, Seefeld, even though he's got this mass following, he is outside the mainstream. But even in the mainstream, you see, they've been reinterpreting Germany's role in World War One, for example. But this book, yes, it's a symptom of a changing attitude in Germany. It's also something that can rapidly accelerate that change when we think about what we've talked about in terms of the power of words. And you're seeing more and more people talk that way in Germany. And he puts these words down and it spreads like wildfire. When Nicholas Frank was on this program, he talked about how Germany never really repented after World War II and always wanted to remain victims. I think we've got time to listen just quickly to that clip.
Would you say after the war there was a repentance? The German people?
I don't know the word repentance.
Repentance means sorrow for what you have done.
No. There was repentance. Whenever I started to talk, they immediately mentioned the bombing of Dresden and the bombing of Munich and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, who started it? Who started it? No. We were the innocent people, and suddenly the English and Americans start to bomb the peaceful Germany.
Right.
And this is, but not only my father, all the people. They suffered a lot. Suddenly they had to suffer. And after the war, we only were the suffering people, not the aggressive one.
And they never repented?
No.
And so he talked about, really, there's been a lot of people having an appetite for this kind of message that have been sympathetic to this view for a long, long time. But there is this building desire in Germany to cast off that history. And we're moving into, as they do that, a period we've never seen before. For most of the post-war period, Germany was divided. They came together in 1990. Right away, you had the Balkan Wars, where a lot of people talked about how that was instigated by Germany. There's still been some reluctance from Germany to appear too overtly aggressive, but that is changing. As I said, Sevela comes along with this message that Germany is the victim, that Germany needs to stand up for itself, to be willing to push others around, and it's hugely popular. People way beyond, say, just a small clique of neo-Nazis want to hear this message. Imagine a politician bringing that kind of message to Germany. That's the kind of message. Speeches along the lines of Sefela's book. Those are the kind of speeches that can change the world. And you can look at kind of the course that Germany is on right now and just say, well, Germany's heading to an inevitable decline. Many people do say that their birth rate's falling, that their population is going to go down, that by 2050, 2060, however it is, they're not, they're going to be this tiny, insignificant power. But you forget the power of individuals and the power of speeches, of words, to change nations, to change the world. And there's a lot of appetite for someone to bring that kind of change to Germany. So continue to watch German politics. You know, the success for Finnish Germania, it shows the great appetite for that kind of message. And the appetite for someone to bring that from the mainstream, to bring that to the German people. So continue to watch that. Continue to watch how Germany can change. That's one of our longest standing forecasts here at The Trumpet. You can go online and read more about that. That's about all we've got time for today. I believe Mr. Stephen Fry will be back tomorrow. So keep listening here at KPCG, listening online at kpcg.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial.